This is the Nuance Podcast by Medicine Explained. We're your hosts, Amanda
and Dan.
We talk to experts on health, the human experience, and the intersection of climate and human health.
We explore the nuance that's been lost in today's conversation. We don't take ads because we want to keep our information unbiased.
But we do need your support. So leave a review on Apple or Spotify.
And share with your friends or on social media.
In today's conversation, we speak with Dr. Renee Lertzman, who is a pioneer and leader at the intersection of psychology, climate, and environment. She applies psychosocial insights to drive engagement and action on ecological issues. She presented a TED Talk titled, How to Turn Climate Anxiety into Action, which has received over 2 million views. Dr. Lertzman founded Project Inside Out, a unique platform, online tool, and resource hub that brings together changemakers, activists, and clinical psychologists to drive sustainable behavior change for our planet. Dr. Lertzman translates psychology and social science best practices into tools, resources, and guidance that unleash the potential for creativity and courage. Today, Dr. Lertzman outlines the experiences people are having and the emotions people are feeling around climate change. She talks about what guiding principles we need to employ in leadership. She gives us advice on effective communication and why communication is so important. Dr. Lertzman also gives us advice on steps we can take to manage our complex emotions about the climate disaster. This was a really wonderful conversation, and we hope you enjoy it. Now, on to the podcast. Hi, Dr. Lertzman. Welcome to the podcast. I'm super excited to chat with you. I've watched your TED Talk and went through your website and just learned so much from you already. And I'm really excited to learn more.
Thank you. I'm excited for this conversation as well.
Awesome. So I'd love to just jump right into it. First of all, what do you do and how did you become interested in climate psychology?
It's always a little hard to describe what I do, but I'll give it a shot. So basically, I run a consultancy. I work with organizations, teams, leaders. I partner with all kinds of programs across sectors. And the focus is really on translating and applying kind of best practice in psychology primarily to how we do our climate, environmental, ESG conservation work. So my work isn't specific to climate, but it has a particular emphasis on climate change as a kind of key existential issue that we're all grappling with. So I run a consultancy. I also have an initiative called Project Inside Out that was started with a grant from the KR Foundation based in Denmark. It's a global initiative. And we provide, it's a platform and provide all kinds of amazing tools and resources for anyone working in the sector. And you asked, how did I get into this? So for me, I've talked about this in a variety of ways. I alluded to it in the TED Talk, but basically for me, it started when I was very young as a teenager. And especially when I went to college, and I was at the time very identified as being a psychologist. So I was taking all the kind of psychology, you know, 101, like really on that track. And I happened to take an environmental studies introduction course at the same time, which was one of those big, you know, if anyone has had that experience of the kind of lecture hall where you kind of do this whole review of here's what's going on. This was in the late 1980s. And, you know, it just completely threw me that we were learning about a whole variety of profound existential planetary issues, crises. It was clear things were like heading on a particular trajectory. And I was emotionally very impacted by this, but I was also intellectually very puzzled why the fields of psychology, you know, which is really about human nature and understanding how and why humans do what we do with global, you know, with ecological crises, that were caused by humans, generated by humans, I didn't really understand why these worlds weren't connected more. So, you know, at that point, I just kind of launched right in.
I resonate with those feelings. I'm a resident in family medicine, and I don't really quite understand why there isn't more talk about climate change as a public health issue. We can't live healthily if we don't have clean air to breathe or clean water to drink. So I resonate with that a lot.
Yeah. So that in itself is a psychological question to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that there are a lot of emotions that can be around climate change. There are some people who are experiencing the impacts directly and they have to deal with those emotions. But then people who, like me, are a little bit intellectually puzzled, like you said, why is this happening? Why aren't people doing more about it? So what are some of the emotions that you've seen around the impacts of climate change?
Mm-hmm. Well, so I think of it not only as emotional, because I believe that the way that these issues are touching us, are impacting us, aren't necessarily even conscious. I think that we are impacted in a whole variety of quite profound ways that many people may not even be fully aware of or able to name until and unless we're invited to start talking about it and articulating it. And then we can start to sort of put some words and framing around what people might be feeling. But I feel very strongly that climate itself, you just acknowledge this disconnect that you're experiencing in the medical context, the public health context. I think that is largely because the domain of climate change itself is complex in that it's really about human practices. It's really about our way of being, our way of living. And that is very connected to our identities, right? And our way of life and kind of what we take as normative, kind of what life is, you know, what is normal life, right? So climate change kind of brings all of that up into question. So as far as emotional, experiential relationship with this, what I've noticed, as well as my colleagues, Leslie Davenport, who's a psychotherapist who really specializes in climate change, Caroline Hickman, who's in the UK, Britt Ray, who is a researcher and writer. So a number of folks are really like shining a light on this. And what we're looking at is the combination of feelings such as powerlessness, number one. So feeling that there's not a whole lot that I can actually do about it. And that in itself triggers a whole variety of additional feelings, right? So it's all kind of cascading. So if we feel powerless and we lack agency, then that itself can bring up a sense of futility. It can bring up a sense of overwhelm. It can bring up sadness. And then there's a whole kind of, so it's almost like there are these categories. And then there's the category that relates to the feelings that come up when we have to really face and come to terms with what this means for us as humans. And that really is about our relationship with change and our relationship with having to let go of some ways of being that are so clearly unsustainable at this point. So there's that. So there can be anger, there can be fear, there can be anxiety. I think it's really important to acknowledge that there's a whole variety of feelings and experiences and that there is no kind of one right or wrong way to feel. You know, there's a lot of talk about anxiety right now. I've been talking about anxiety for 30 years. You know, to me, it was very obvious that this is anxiety producing, but some people aren't feeling anxious. Some people might be feeling more numb, you know, or grief or whatever. So I think it's extremely important to just be as open and kind of nuanced about the relationship with the issues as we can.
I think that kind of leads into the next question pretty well, because there are a lot of different emotions that people can have, and some people feel like powerless or numb. And I think there's a lot of conversation in the climate movement about how to frame climate change in general. Is it a hopeful topic? Should we be forcing kind of like the scientific facts down people's throats? And I think a lot of people who are trying to project more hope about the process say that we have this window of tolerance that you mentioned in your TED talk, so that if we're stressed and overstressed, then we'd kind of just shut down. So do you mind explaining what is window of tolerance and how does it apply to the conversation?
Sure. So the window of tolerance is actually a concept that was created by Dr. Daniel Siegel, who is he's a psychiatrist, neuroscientist. He's actually a therapist, and he has been very effective at creating kind of concepts and frames that articulate, frankly, like how we regulate ourselves in terms of regulating our nervous system. So the window of tolerance is this wonderful, I feel like I, when I hear it, I can see it. It's like I'm holding my hands up like they're a window. And so on the one side, when people are aroused with a lot of stress, primarily, we tend to either go into a sort of a shutdown, kind of withdrawal, numbing, kind of collapse response. And then on the other side of that spectrum is that more like activation, aggression, you know, really hitting out, like that kind of energy that goes out. So there's a collapse, and then there's this kind of activation, anger, aggression. And many of us, when we get stimulated, when we're overwhelmed, we tend to be somewhere in between there, right? And we all have different ways of coping. And so what he's talking about here is really, it's really about resilience. It's about how do we widen our window of tolerance when it comes to our ability to stay with and hold challenging, difficult, uncomfortable awareness, experience, and so forth. Now, he generated that in the context of working with people around trauma. And what it really is shining a light on is the role of relationships and relationality. So everything I do is about bringing a relational lens to climate change, which is to say that to stay in our window of tolerance, to widen and stay in that window, requires this ability to feel safe, to feel connected, to feel like you're not alone, and to feel like you make sense to others or to someone else. So again, if we think of this in the therapeutic context, it's the, you know, the therapist and the client, and there's that kind of whole attunement, like being in connection with each other. What I'm looking at is how do we apply this and translate this to the climate crisis, which is activating, which is traumatizing, which does pop people often out of their window of tolerance, where they either shut down or they become hyperactive, you know, activated. And so to me, this is a much more accurate way and grounded way of looking at this than hope and despair. So I'm one of those people who feel that that framing is not particularly helpful. If you ask me, you know, do I feel hopeful? Do I feel despairing? That doesn't resonate with how I relate with the issues, which is much more about, it's a yes and, or it's a both and. It's sort of like, yeah, I mean, you know, with a summer like the one we've had, you know, we need to really be able to be with that, to face that, to bear witness to that, but not necessarily collapse into a sense of doom and despair. But I feel like it's really important to have permission to have those feelings, but to know that that's not actually, that's not the whole story. The whole story is that we often cycle in and out of feeling at any given time, optimistic, hopeful, encouraged, sad, discouraged, overwhelmed, frustrated, motivated, like even sometimes in a single day or a single hour, you know, we can be cycling through these different ways of relating with the issues. So the question is to me, how do we hold space? How do we create space and context for us to stay in that window, to stay in relationship, to feel like, hey, you know what? It's okay to feel down sometimes. It doesn't mean I'm a quote doomer. You know, I really think that's super just unhelpful language. Like, I mean, come on. It's like, I can't imagine saying to someone who comes to see me, who's working with some really painful material or some trauma, like, oh, you're just being like such a doomer. It's like, no, it's a very natural and normal human response to very difficult, you know, conditions. The reframe is, how can we and I like support each other? How can we connect and sort of keep each other in that window?
Yeah, I love that. And that's why we called our podcast The Nuance, because there's so much more to the story than just being, are you optimistic about it or pessimistic about it? And it's like, this is such a complex topic, and human beings are so complex within themselves that we have to, like you said, hold space for all of those emotions.
Yeah, totally. I love that you're called the nuance.
Thank you. And so I think that you work in like the consulting, like you said, and in your project Inside Out, there's a lot about leadership and how we relate to one another. So do you mind just expanding a little bit on like what you're looking for or would kind of guide leaders to do in the climate crisis? And I know there's different types of leaders that you lay out in your website and in your project. And then how we should be relating to one another in order to like be involved and engaged in this.
Yeah, thank you. That's a great question. So the main kind of focus of Project Inside Out is to encourage all of us to see ourselves as change makers, change leaders, and as guides. So the framing for me that has been really powerful is to invite leaders into a mindset of what does it mean to be a guide and what changes in the way that I do what I do if it is, in that mode of guiding. So when you go to the site, for example, there's a bit of a quiz. It's kind of playful, but we ask people to reflect on how are you showing up? And I came up with these modes after working with a lot of different organizations and leaders and educators. And I realized that there's usually these kind of modes of showing up, which is some people are educators. And so they feel that it's up to them to make sure everyone has the information. They are always armed with all the resources, all the material. It's like, here, let me give you my PowerPoint, my presentation. So that's the educator. There's a cheerleader, which is, oh, I have to keep everyone feeling really inspired and upbeat all the time and like solutions and let's be hopeful. And it's just that kind of that like feeling like you have to keep it upbeat and, you know, cheerleading. And then there's writing, which is R-I-G-H-T, which is taken right out of the motivational interviewing literature and research, which is to write at people, to basically be that kind of moral activist, to say, this is the right thing to do. You know, if you cared, we'd be doing more. So there's that kind of like what we call writing, the writing reflex. And then there's guiding. And so what I'm really inviting us to step into is that mindset of a guide. And what it means to be a guide, first and foremost, is that you really have to be attuned. You have to practice this ability to tune in, to be attunement is a term that I use quite a lot. It again comes out of the clinical world. And it really means understanding and being tuned in, like, you know, the ability for me to be attuned to you and what you're bringing, what your experience is. And if we really apply that fully to leadership style, strategy, program design, organizational strategy, it really fundamentally changes a lot about the way that we do our work. And so I have on Project Inside Out, we have these guiding principles. And in a way, that's the playbook for being a guide. And again, this is taken from motivational interviewing, from clinical psychology, from trauma-informed work. It's sort of a distillation of these best practices. And in a nutshell, it's basically attuning, so being tuned in, so really knowing how to listen, how to hold space, how to ask questions, how to draw out from the others, as opposed to just coming in and sort of pushing at people. Reveal is how to communicate more effectively. That's actually emotionally intelligent, emotionally empathetic. So this is, how do we talk or communicate with people about climate crises in a way that is attuned? So that might be saying, look, you know, I get that, you know, these issues are really complex and overwhelming. I feel that way too. You know, are you open to having this interaction or having a conversation? Do you want to hear what I have to say about it? So it's just like skillful communicating. And then we talk about equipping people with tools and resources so that, you know, you're basically guiding and enabling others, convening people in conversation, in group process, but basically showing up as a convener is a big reframe for a lot of climate environmental leaders who are used to feeling like they have to run something or drive something, but convening is... my leadership shows up in my ability to bring people together and to direct the conversation in a way that's actually productive, that invites diverse, different perspectives, to be able to invite and encourage debate, disagreement, like all of that is really powerful. And then sustain is the fifth guiding principle, which is how do we keep this going? How do we get out of this tendency to think about only the next pledge, the next commitment, the next goal, the next election cycle, the next COP, the next, you know, global event? You know, like, how do we actually think about this much more long term? And all of those principles really kind of come together and work very synergistically.
I love those guiding principles. I took your quiz online. I learned a lot through the quiz. It was really fun.
Did you learn?
Well, I actually ended up being a guiding type of leadership. But I don't know if that was something just like innately how I interact with people, or I think that a lot of the way that us as family medicine physicians are trained, because it is a lot of like listening to folks, trying to attune to their situation, meeting people where they're at. And then doing just like small changes. We do learn motivational interviewing as well. So I think that's just kind of become part of the way that I communicate with folks.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, I feel like if more of us took on the practices and motivational interviewing, we would all be so much more effective.
Yes, communication is a big thing that is very important in all aspects, no matter what. And I think sometimes is falling short.
Yes. Well, yeah. It falls short when we, because of our sense of urgency, mm-hmm. because of how much we care, that can short circuit that capacity to be more present, patient, curious, like all of that tends to go out the window when you're like, wait a minute, like we've got to do something right now. It's very, very hard, which is why I've loved my training with different motivational interviewing coaches and trainers, is, you know, sitting in a room full of medical professionals who know a great deal. You know the science, you know all the research, you know the urgency, you know if someone doesn't stop doing what they're doing, they are putting their lives and others at risk. So there's that sense of like, we need to change this now. And to watch how much more effective we are when we have strategies for managing our own internal kind of drive, right? And that's what I love. I could just listen to MI trainers like all the time. I love how it's just so wise. It's so wise and insightful, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And you kind of talked about how some of the communication falls a little bit short because we feel this necessity that things have to be urgent and do things now. Are there any other things in leadership right now that you feel like can maybe not specifically be 100% the way that you lay out, but are some of the ways that we're falling short in the way that we're communicating or leading in the climate movement right now?
Right. So my fantasy is that we can somehow integrate some of these practices into how we advance policy. Mm-hmm. The primary way of doing that, which I have had experience with on a project where I advised a conservative Republican advisor who was working with the GOP at the time in 2014, he himself wanted to engage conservatives on climate change. So we did in-depth interviews with conservative Republican climate skeptics around the United States. And I trained him in doing these interviews using a lot of the MI, like deep listening, reflective listening. As a result, what we got were these underlying anxieties and ambivalence and aspirations that people had in relation to climate crisis, including, again, like climate skeptics. We then took that and designed a messaging strategy that affirmed and acknowledged those anxieties and the ambivalence and the aspiration. And then we found that that was just incredibly successful. So it was like a home run. Now, we all know that that particular intervention didn't necessarily have a lot of impact. And that's because, you know, it's going to take more than a messaging campaign. So we actually created what I think probably is one of the most successful messaging on climate change for conservative Republicans in the States. It was briefed to every member of the Republican GOP. Like, he literally briefed all of them on it. It didn't really go anywhere, even though we were saying, hey, your people are resonating with this messaging. It didn't go anywhere because they weren't able to translate that into a way of really having conversations about the issue. So in response to your question, I think we need more messaging, leadership messaging that is truly empathetic, that basically says, look, like, you probably feel this, you probably feel that, you're feeling overwhelmed, you're feeling vulnerable, you think your freedoms are going to be taken away, or that people are going to tell you what to do, or we're going to lose all these things that we fought really hard for. And it's like, why do we say, you know, like, all this, just even if you don't, you have to like put aside what you feel is true and name, like, yeah, you might think Al Gore is, you know, a total hypocrite because he flies around the globe. Like, we literally had the person say that. So you have to be able to really design our messaging and the way we approach policy through that lens. We need to be having these conversations. We need to train people to go out and have these conversations so that people feel like no matter what they think or feel about the issue, that they can actually name it and express it. And then it's only then that we can actually make any kind of progress. Otherwise, people dig in and there's just like total resistance, right? Because it's like people feel like they're not being understood.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that. I was actually just interviewing a pediatrician who works a lot on climate change policy for the APA, the American Pediatric Association, just a couple of days ago. And she said that there was a study done from people from both sides of the aisle, completely partisan, and everyone is open to discussing climate change or the impacts of climate change with their physicians. So I'm trying to get more people to talk about it in the clinic because it is really directly related to our health. And that's like, you know, meeting people where they're at, what matters to you. Yeah. And then, of course, that's not from the grass tops, but a little bit more grassroots, but just continuing the conversation. That's just really what we need to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I think also acknowledging that the issues, you know, can be overwhelming. So I think that there's a lot of assumptions being made that this has to be hit people where it's felt, like where this becomes real for me. Yes and no. I mean, a lot of us working in this space are engaged with it without having needed to be directly impacted by what's happening, we extend our imaginations. We have a sense of empathy for future generations. So I believe very strongly that many, many humans have those capacities. But what shuts that down and gets in the way is that we actually feel often overwhelmed. We feel like the scale is just too big. And therefore, we cognitively kind of shut down around it. So I think it's really important to acknowledge the existential, not necessarily using that term, but basically saying, yeah, this is like big. This is big. This is a lot. This is a lot. This is kind of overwhelming. And it might seem completely just beyond. And that said, you know, we're in this moment right now as human beings. And if we can find a way to navigate this together, then we actually, you know, our lives could be even better than they are now. Like, you know, there's so much potential, but I think it's really key to speak to that, because I believe that that's the primary factor that leads to people shutting down.
Yeah. So we've talked a lot about different styles of communication, how we can lead in different ways and kind of be guides within this climate movement. If people are experiencing overwhelming emotions across the spectrum about climate change, what are some of the first steps that you recommend that we do?
Right. Well, there's a few things. One is initiate conversations, gatherings, convenings amongst your networks. So basically, you know, whether that's inviting people to get together or at your home or whatever, but showing up in that way to say, hey, you know, just want to invite some people to get together and just be with each other around how we're feeling, right, around these issues. So I think it's really important to connect with others, to resource yourself in that way. Then there's joining groups, initiatives that are already happening. So the Climate Psychology Alliance, for example, in North America has a variety of programs. There's, you know, climate cafes, and there's a growing movement of places where you can go to just connect with each other. Now, some people process their feelings by being just active and engaged. So not everyone wants or needs to go and talk about how they're feeling. And I think it's really important to consider what kind of groups or activities or programs are happening that feel resonant with you. Like what feels like from a culture perspective, like some people might be drawn to being involved with a local chapter of Sierra Club, or some people might want to be more, you know, connected with a local nature center. Maybe it's a startup kind of community, or, you know, it's like, I think it really depends on where you're at and what you're interested in. But get, like, basically do, like, connect in some way. Like, the most powerful thing we can do is to do something, even if it's literally talking with people. And I feel very strongly that our ability to talk with other people is itself a very powerful form of action, that not everything has to be, like, you know, I mean, I just feel like the term action is thrown around all the time, and it's kind of meaningless. It's like, okay, act on what? Like, what am I supposed to do? And then we short circuit. So I think it's important to just kind of reflect on, okay, I'm having these feelings, I'm having this experience. What can I do that connects me with other people, ideally, so that I know that I'm part of a much, much vast network of millions and millions of people around the world who are all engaging in some way or another. And then there's bringing it into your work, your context, your community. Like, I think that's also kind of what Project Inside Out is about, is saying, if you care about these issues, you can be a guide. And it can look like a whole variety of things. It doesn't have to look like, you know, what we might have in our mind is like a climate leader. It's like, literally, if you're a doctor, if you're a physician, if you're a nurse, if you're in the medical space, like, how do you start to kind of creatively weave this in? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's one of the coolest things about this movement is that literally whatever background you come from, you can have something to offer. Like if you have a background in art, just like communicating through artwork is really impactful and important. And everyone has a skill that they can bring if they want to bring it.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Writing poetry, you know, like making films. Like, again, it's so important that everyone really honors their unique contribution, no matter what it is.
Yeah, perfect. And Dr. Lertzman, we end all of our podcasts with asking the guests the following question. The future is blank.
The future is dynamic, complicated, and full of possibility and potential.
I love that. Complicated, nuanced.
Exactly.
And is there anything else that you want to leave our listeners with?
Just an expression of gratitude for this conversation, for you inviting me to be on your podcast, and, you know, to just really hold ourselves with a lot of kindness, compassion, and gentleness right now.
Thank you so much. This was such a wonderful conversation. I love everything that you're doing. And thank you for all the work that you do.
Thank you so much. Likewise.